Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat.
Hello to all of my Jiu-Jitsu brothers and sisters and fellow martial artists out there. I hope you guys had a fantastic Easter weekend and that you got some relaxation in and spent some good time with the family. Before we get into episode 37, which is an interview with Ryan Ford, who's the host of Grappling Central, I just wanted to let you guys know, I've been telling you about it for a few weeks now, my new virtual or online dojo, the Master Academy, is now open for enrollment. We launched on Friday, and I'm so excited about this. You guys who are listening, you can get 10% off all the membership options if you use the coupon code podcast when you enroll. All you need to do is head on over to jiu-jitsu-master-academy.com. That's jiu-jitsu-master-academy.com. You know, many years ago, I was seeking for answers about certain things in life. And one of the pieces of wisdom that I found was one of the most important questions you can ask is, how can I give my gifts back to the world? And I have been blessed with certain things in my life, not a huge amount of them, but one of them is I have the gift of teaching jiu-jitsu and being able to make it simple and easy to understand for people. And what I really tried to do with the Master Academy is package the essence of what I do and the way I teach into something that people who aren't physically near me can use and employ to make their jiu-jitsu much better. I can guarantee you that if you use the Master Academy and implement what's in it, your jiu-jitsu is going to jump in a massive way. So head on over to Jiu-Jitsu Master Academy. There's also a link in the episode description. And sign up using the coupon code podcast and you'll get a discount. Hope you guys enjoy it. In fact, I don't need to hope. I know you guys will enjoy that. Anyway, let's get into the show. This is Ryan Ford. Enjoy. Hello, everyone. I hope you had a fantastic weekend. Welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show. I'm here with, I don't want to say a lowly purple belt, but because most of the time we have black belts and you are only a purple belt, but that means you must be a special cat because I wouldn't have someone on the show who wasn't a black belt unless they had something interesting to say. This is Ryan Ford, who runs the Grappling Central podcast. Thanks for coming on the show, Ryan.
No, Nick, it's an honor to be here. I really appreciate the invite.
For sure. Please don't take offense at the lowly purple belt coming. I'm just messing around.
Not at all, man. No, like I said, it's great to be here. You've had some excellent guests and great conversations on your show, and I'm thrilled to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. I can just hear instantly the difference between you and 99% of the other people I speak to. It's that you speak for a living. You can hear it. Your voice is very, I think, mellifluous is the word, and your intonation is excellent. So that's it's going to be cool, except for the fact that it makes me sound bad.
Not at all. I appreciate that, though.
So, but it's my understanding that we're speaking, you're in Atlanta at the moment.
Correct. Yes. Right now I'm in Atlanta.
Okay. So the first thing I wanted to talk to you about is you've been training for how long? It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. So I started jiu-jitsu in 2005 in September, and that's a long time. It's about 12 years. So when people hear that I'm still a purple belt, the first reaction is, wow, you must suck. So it's what it really is that when I first started, I got into jiu-jitsu out of a enamoration with MMA. I was really, really, really into MMA, and I still am a big MMA fan. But for me, jiu-jitsu was kind of a partial focus on what I was trying to accomplish. I wanted to get really good at Muay Thai and boxing and wrestling and jiu-jitsu. So I was sort of dividing up my time between those things. And jiu-jitsu was something I really enjoyed and really liked. And ever since I was a kid, I saw Royce Gracie do his thing in the early UFC days with my dad when I was a kid, and was always fascinated by jiu-jitsu, but I grew to really just become passionate about MMA. So the first few years that I was doing, that I was training, it was kind of split up between different stuff. And that kind of changed over time. Over time, I eventually really became passionate about jiu-jitsu through a couple different experiences that I had that were really cornerstones in my journey.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So, I mean, it is great in a way that you had experience and exposure to all these different styles, and you've been, it's my understanding, training under a bunch of different academies for a long time as well. But I guess it forces you into that strange kind of, you're one of the lost boys who's been like moving between clubs, so your grading takes much longer. There's a lot of guys like that I've met. You know, it's not because they're not good at jiu-jitsu, it's just because they happen to move or they change instructors. And you know how it is, like, you're most of the time your instructor wants to see you prove yourself under him before he gives you a belt. And I can understand that must be very frustrating.
Yeah, that's actually another big factor within that. I started training under Eddie Camden here in Atlanta at an academy called Tiger Academy. Mm-hmm. And he was a black belt under Pedro Sauer. And I trained with him for the first, I believe, 7 or 8 years of my training. And then I had a kind of a crazy situation happen that also took off some time away from my my training, which is another factor as well. I had two big gaps in training. The first one was in 2007. I attempted college for a couple of years, or for about a year and a half, which took a lot of time away from any kind of training. And then the second one was in 2011. I met my wife, who was at the time my fiance, and she got stuck in Brazil where she's from. And we had some visa issues getting her back when she went to go visit family between semesters. And so that also was kind of a derailing in my training. The main thing was, when I got back from my hiatus after getting Karen's visa situation taken care of, I ended up switching academies. I ended up finding just a path that I liked a little bit better than I was previously on. I was really focused on the sport side of jiu-jitsu. My first academy was very self-defense focused, which was very valuable for my own knowledge, and it's, you know, helped me a lot in different aspects of my life. But I was really into the sportive side, which I felt like I hadn't had a ton of exposure to. So I ended up training at Alliance headquarters under Jacare Cavalcanti, who's a red and white belt now. At the time, he was a coral belt in jiu-jitsu, and really grew a lot there. Spent about 2 years there. And then my wife got a job way outside the city, so it got to be really difficult to make that drive every day back and forth through Atlanta traffic. I'm not sure if you've been to Atlanta, but don't come during rush hour. It's a nightmare. So we ended up living out towards Creighton MMA, which is Henzo Gracie Atlanta. Paul Creighton is a phenomenal black belt. He's directly under Henzo. He came up alongside John Danaher and Sean Williams, and he's one of Matt Serra's best friends. So he's really, really great jiu-jitsu pedigree. But he was also a stud junior college wrestler and a black belt in judo. So he's got like phenomenal takedown applications to his training. And, you know, my brother and I have known him since we were white belts, because he was a good friend of our original instructor. So it was a real natural move for me. I looked on the GPS and he was only like 5 minutes from where Karen and I were staying. So I've been there ever since. And you're right. That has been a little bit of a hurdle, is that, you know, if you're starting at one place and you're consistently training under the same person, then naturally you're going to get ranked quicker than you would if you're having to switch teams all the time and having to kind of fit in and get to know people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, naturally, any good black belt is going to want to observe, you know, new students coming in, not just start immediately promoting them, because you don't know if that guy's a scumbag or if he's, you know, if he's a good person, or, you know, it's just naturally going to be some time that they have to get to know you.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Did you get called out as a traitor or a creon?
No. You know, the thing is, I made it a point that anytime I left any academy, that I sat down in person with the instructor and just explained the situation. Mm-hmm. The first academy I left, it's kind of a weird situation. I won't get into it that much, but I just felt the need to find something else. And then the second time when I had to leave Alliance, just because of the distance, I went in person and sat with Master Jacare and just said, "Hey, look, you know, I've grown so much here. I love this academy. You're an amazing instructor. It's just getting so difficult for me to drive the hour through traffic every day, in rush hour, no less. I used to have to go straight from the office I worked at directly to the academy, and it was just real, real drag." And so he understood. And, you know, Jacare's been on my podcast a couple times, and I still remain great friends with him. In fact, his wife is a friend of my wife's. So it's all good. And I think that's an important thing that when people leave an academy or when you find yourself in a situation where you have to switch teams just due to outside reasons, if you just leave and not say anything, or if you tell someone through a text or an email or something, that's not really the best route to go.
Yeah. I'm reminded of something I read many years back, which is, a man is not remembered by how he starts things, but how he finishes them. And that always stuck with me. I had a girlfriend, like, she had been my longtime girlfriend, and she was stuck in South Africa. I was in England. And I remember I wrote, it came to the point where we had to break up, we'd grown apart, and it was time, you know, it was time for us to both move on. And I wrote her a letter, and before I posted it, I gave it to my best friend at the time, and I said, I'm going to send her this. And he didn't even read it, he just picked it up, and he said, okay, dude, so you've been with this person for X number of years, and that's what this relationship is worth to you. That's how you're going to finish it, through a letter. And I remember I just walked into my room and booked a ticket to South Africa there and then, because I realized, like, he was right. I didn't want to finish. I didn't want to be known as that guy that broke up with his girlfriend via a letter. You know what I mean? And I think it's tied in to what you've said about you want to end things on, you want to be remembered by how you finish it. And I respect that. I respect that you did that, because the easiest thing would be to just fade away, kind of like cancel your direct debit and then just like stop going. And then your instructor starts thinking, oh, you didn't enjoy it here, or something's not right. But to go and sit down as a man face to face, I really respect that. I think that's the right thing to do.
Thank you. And that's exactly how I felt too. I think I've seen a lot of people in jiu-jitsu obviously come and go, and some of them drop off and just stop training completely. And some of them, you know, switch other schools or move away or whatever. And I always admired the guys that came in and just sort of, you know, express their situation. And I've also noticed that the guys that do that are always welcomed back. Like if they're in town visiting, or if they swing by the academy sometimes to say hi, they're really well received. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other guys, maybe it's a little bit more awkward, or it's a little, I don't know, you know, just kind of weird. They left for another team and then didn't say anything really, but then dropped back in. Now it's just kind of like, oh, okay, well, what's up? What are you doing here?
Yeah,
you
know? For sure. So, yeah. I understand as well the travel issue that you speak about. I think it's not so bad anymore, because there's more and more academies popping up all the time. But even 10 years ago, to find a quality jiu-jitsu academy, you might be living far away, and it might be an hour to get there. And I can understand if some place opens up down the street that's only 5 minutes away. I mean, an example is my best friend. He started to train with us at with my friend Mark at Jiu-Jitsu Brother in London, and he was training twice a week. And it was such a pleasure for me to watch. He was getting better at jiu-jitsu. He had a couple of stripes in his white belt, and he was tapping the odd guy out. And I could see like he was getting fitter, and like the benefits were starting to manifest. And he just said to me, man, you know, I love training with you guys, and I love doing jiu-jitsu, but it's an hour on the bus after work each day, an hour to the gym and then an hour back. And I finish work at like 6:30, get to the gym at 7:30, we finish 9:30, and then I get home at like 11, and I just can't do it anymore. And I had to understand, dude. I mean, like, what? And Mark as well. Mark, of course, he understood. What kind of person would be like, oh, you're a traitor, you're waving someone else's flag, or like you're a bad person? I mean, that's just bullshit.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that there always are going to be those kind of mindless people who just automatically assume that if someone leaves a school, it's like, oh, he's a traitor. And it's like, yeah. Well, dude, have you taken a moment to even hear the situation? Like, you know, maybe I'm moving away. Maybe I've gotten something else going on in my life. So I think any knee-jerk reaction to anything typically makes me judge people's.
I can guarantee you as well that those guys are complaining about you being a traitor. They wouldn't be complaining if you still carried on paying each month, and even if you weren't there, that'd be totally fine with that. That's just one thing to keep in mind. So I wanted to ask you about, you said your wife is from Brazil and she got stuck there with a visa issue. The last time you and I spoke, which must be close to a year ago, I remember you were just about to move to Brazil. Is that still on the cards, or?
Yeah, it is. So, man, it's so everything with Karen and I's marriage has been just crazy because of the immigration issues. So Karen and I met when we were dating while she was in school here. She's from Sao Paulo. She's from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And she came here to learn English, and then she started taking courses in school here. And we started dating then. And ever since then, like her student visa expired at one point in 2011. She'd already renewed it twice because she had been studying for a little while. And so she just figured, okay, well, I'm going to go down to Brazil this time, see my little brother. Her little brother was like 5 at the time, so she was really missing him and stuff. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to go for a week to Brazil, see my family, all that, renew my student visa, and then I'll be back in a week. So, you know, she went and did that. And then when she tried to renew it, they wouldn't renew it for some reason. And no one will give you a straight answer why. And she went to the consulate in Sao Paulo, and then she went to the consulate in Rio. And both places were like, no, we can't renew it because, you know, there's just some bureaucratic weird answer that didn't really have any clear definition to why she couldn't get back in. But the point was she was stuck. So I had to pretty much stop what I was doing. And at the time I was working security in the evening and teaching kids jujitsu classes in the day. In other words, I was making very little money. I was not making a lot of money. And so I had to pretty much stop what I was doing and figure out, okay, I need to figure out how I'm going, because I know I want to marry this girl. So I got to figure out now how in the world I'm going to make this happen while she's stuck in South America and while I'm making, you know, entry level money. So we eventually I was able to get a trip down there, and I proposed to her, and then she was ended up still having to stay in Brazil for 2 years before I was able to bring her back to the U.S. And so a lot of Skype credits were used, and a lot of and in fact you said you had a long distance thing with between South Africa and London, so you know how that is.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was crazy, man. But eventually we got her back, and yeah, now the plan is to pretty much. We want to live down there. So she's about to become a U.S. citizen now. And we got married 5 years ago. So pretty much we're just waiting for her U.S. citizenship to clear. So that way we can both be dual citizens. We were in Brazil all of September, and I was able to become a resident down there. So that'll basically transfer into a citizenship later over time. So, yeah, and it's cool because, you know, I run the podcast full time now, and Karen is a graphic designer, so she can kind of work online as well. So we realized about, you know, a year and a half ago that, hey, you know, if this is something that kind of takes off or at least gets to a level where I can pay bills, which is pretty much where we're at now with the podcast anyway, that we can live wherever we want. So I'd love to be able to spend a year or two before having kids or anything and become fluent in Portuguese and train down there. And, you know,
have you done any training down there yet, Ryan?
Yeah, I have. I got that. So in 2012, when I went down there to propose to her and spend time with her, we took a trip to Rio. I trained at De La Riva's Academy, which was amazing, in Copacabana. And then I got to go to the original Gracie Humaita. So Holker and Hoyler run that school. But when I was there, Hoyler was in San Diego, and I got to train with Holker and do his class. When I say train with, obviously I was learning from him. I was not one of his training partners. Then we also got to go to Damian Maia Academy in Sao Paulo, which was awesome. And that's actually most likely where I'm going to be training once we move down there.
What advice would you give to the average gringo listening to this who wants to head down to Brazil and do some training? Like, what do you think they need to prepare for? And what do you think they need to look for when it comes to academies?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the main thing that I would say is that above all else, you have to really make sure that you're prepared to stay safe. You know, Brazil's an incredible country. It's beautiful. It's amazing. The people are awesome. But it is a third world country. And there are some risks that I think exist that we oftentimes become complacent in the United States and abroad that don't exist in other places. So, for example, you know, I see every time, like during the Olympics, there was this whole news expose thing about tourists getting robbed and things like that in Rio. And you go back and you look at some of the like tapes and the videos that were surfacing on YouTube and social media of people getting robbed. And it's like they're walking around with like bags, like Tiffany & Co. bags, and like talking on their iPhone 6. It's like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you can't do that down there. Like, so and the funny thing about it is the consulate usually tells people that there's like a little an info pamphlet thing saying, hey, it's recommended that, you know, maybe don't wear flashy jewelry, maybe don't have like the latest and greatest technology on your ear all day if you're walking around, you know, the streets of Rio or Sao Paulo or Brazil. And, you know, there's things like that I think people become complacent with and just don't think of. So the big thing is I always recommend that everyone dress down, just live humble, just be humble, just wear, you know, when I'm down there, I'm usually wearing board shorts, a t-shirt and flip flops. And, you know, and that's pretty much it. I don't carry cash around with me really. I don't try to get any sort of attention whatsoever. I'm already a white guy with blue eyes and everything. It's going to get enough attention as it is. So, you know, so I try to just blend in the best as possible.
Yeah,
and
good advice. I think a lot of it. You know what? For me, I definitely will agree that Rio. I've only been to Rio, not to any other part of Brazil, but I remember that was one of the few places on all my travels where I didn't feel safe. Like, I remember me and a couple of other jiu-jitsu guys, we were walking along the Copacabana promenade. It was like early one evening. And I mean, like, this was, we were three, like 20 something jiu-jitsu guys. Like, we didn't look like chumps, and we didn't have huge cameras or Tiffany bags or anything like that. But still, I remember the one guy that we were walking with, he just whispered to me, he said, okay, don't look now, but these four dudes are following us. And I remember thinking to myself, like, fucking hell, like, this is nothing like this has ever happened to me anywhere else, or even remotely. We managed to, like, kind of let these dudes know that we were aware of them, and kind of, you know, we made our presence a little bit stronger, and they eventually dissipated. But still, like, I kept thinking to myself, wow, this is not necessarily a safe place, which is not to say you're in mortal danger, but you just got to keep your eyes open. And I remember my dad, actually, my dad's quite a tough dude. He doesn't do jiu-jitsu or anything, but he's a karate black belt, and he's a proper alpha male dude. And he got robbed at knife point in Brazil one night. This was like 30, 40 years ago. And I never forget him telling me that story, how he chased this dude, like, trying to get his money back. And, like, then it was a long story. But anyway, the point is, Brazil is definitely not a place to be taken lightly if you want to go there on a vacation. I think it's about, you said it best, it's about just trying to blend in and not being the big, loud dude who's, like, walking around, like, where's my Starbucks type.
Right,
then
exactly.
Then you're going to get caught for sure. The thing that was the biggest shock to me for the training experience in Brazil, and I'm sure it's probably not too different from Atlanta, but it's the humidity and the heat, man. The first week or two, my body really struggled to adjust to that, because a 5-minute match in that heat and humidity is compared to like a 10-minute match in like a mild climate, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's a major factor. That's another thing that's for sure that if you're going to be going down to Brazil to train, be prepared for that. Most places don't have heating and air in Brazil. It's usually just fans and windows. And the places that you see air conditioning are going to be like either really rich people or like Walmart or hotel, like nice hotels. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I trained in Brazil was actually at De La Riva's Academy in Copacabana. And it's funny because he's in a it's actually a surprisingly small location. You know, when you think of Ricardo de la Riva, you're like, oh man, he must have this massive academy down there. And it's really not. It's a very intimate, like, nice, it's a nice school, but it's very small, and it's not some massive space. And it's in the bottom of a like a YMCA type gym called Equipe Un, which means team number one. And so you go there, and you go down these steps, you walk through the whole gymnasium. So imagine walking through like an LA Fitness type of place. And then you go downstairs to this pool area. There's this big swimming pool where they do laps and stuff. And then right off to the side of the pool is this door that leads into a big room for De La Riva's Academy. And so there's no windows, there's no AC. I think they had a little bit of a fan thing in the corner, kind of. And it was sweltering, Nick. It
was so hot.
Yeah, and we ended up just training and training and training. was just having such a great time, but I didn't realize, like, you know, I guess I just didn't, I sort of after a while forgot just how hot and humid it was. And by the time I was done, I spent like 3 hours training there. And by the time I was done, we walk outside and I'm thinking like, okay, man, I'm really overheated. Like my shirt's sticking to me. I'm running short of breath. I just need to open the door outside, you know, to the street and I'll be okay. And we swing the door open and it's hotter outside.
That's so great.
My knees buckled. I had to kind of sit down for a minute. Yeah. And it was starting to get a little dark. So now at that point, I'm like, man, like I hope now if we're walking through the dark and something happens, like I'm not really in any fighting shape. So yeah. I hope Karen's gonna, like, swing her purse hard. You know?
That's great. So, yeah, dude. Yeah. I know one thing that kind of climate is good for is weight loss. I mean, I remember once I lost in one training session. This was in Thailand. But I lost like 4 pounds. I weighed myself before the training session and right after, and I literally lost 4 pounds. Obviously, a lot of it's water, but still, I mean, you go and train in those conditions for like 3 to 4 weeks, and you're gonna lose a lot of fat as well. You're gonna be in good shape. So, I always recommend to people, like, they wanna, you know, if they wanna turn their lives around, like, you know, that maybe they're out of shape and they've let themselves go a little bit and they want like an intensive thing. It's like, go do Muay Thai or Jiu-Jitsu in a place like Brazil or Thailand for a month and you will very quickly get back in shape if you're not eating too much acai, I guess.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, another great thing about that I love about Brazil is the food is so incredibly good. Yeah. And you have to be, I mean, obviously you have to mind what you eat. You can't just, you know, eat whatever. But I was able to eat really good food that they serve pretty much everywhere. And one nice thing about it is that you don't gain a lot of weight from their food necessarily because, A, people walk all the time. Like walking, you can walk like 15, 20 miles, and that's considered like a normal trip to go somewhere. And then secondly, like you said, the heat really helps. Obviously, a lot of it's water weight, but you still sweat and you move and your body gets warm. And also, you know, the nice thing about Brazil is they don't put a lot of the same crap that they put in the food here in the U.S. There's a lot of preservatives and things that are very bad for the human body that really shouldn't be in food that down there, they don't allow it. They don't allow things like high fructose corn syrup in the food and things like that. So I'm convinced that just the cleanliness of their food down there has a lot
definitely.
To do as well.
It's this friend of mine. It's an older guy, very, very interesting man. He's an investment banker that spends a lot of time in Switzerland. And he was telling me how when he goes to Switzerland, he goes and stays in this little place in the Alps. And he says you can eat like a 5-course meal, including like a massive dessert. And he says you never feel full. You don't feel like stuffed and heavy like at the end of the meal. And he said it's because the quality of the ingredients is so good. Everything's fresh and there's no preservatives. And that really stuck with me. And it's just start to realize that, yeah, that the quality of the food in industrialized nations can sometimes be pretty crappy. So I'm very interested when you say you've had a similar experience. You know, Ryan, I wanted to ask you, I think it's a question only you will be able to answer because you've got this super successful podcast on that's got a very specific niche, which is you interview grappling luminaries is probably the best word. So I wanted to ask, and you've interviewed a lot of them, your podcast has been going for a while now, it's very well established. What common traits or characteristics have you found between all these guys and girls that you've interviewed, these like jiu-jitsu black belts and world champions and minor jiu-jitsu celebrities, I guess? Well, what is the one thing that, if there is one, that you've noticed about them that they have in common?
No, great question. That's actually, and you'll get a kick out of this one too, because it was the first time I noticed this trait was with Hodger when I had Professor Hodger on the show. I would say that it's obsession. And I noticed it with Hodger during our discussion because I was asking him about sort of how he keeps himself accountable for his training and for his progression as a black belt and as a competitor. And he got into this whole thing and it gave me goosebumps when he was talking about it because he really started to open up and kind of expose his psyche a little bit. And he was explaining that when he's training or when he's competing, if everything is not flawless, if it's not, I mean, perfect, he's not happy with it. So, for example, if he goes on and has several amazing matches, beats everybody by submitting them, and wins a world championship, he won't think for a second about, oh, I just became another a world champion again. He thinks, man, that guy, he scrambled before I could sweep him, and I didn't land that sweep I wanted to land. And that's literally, it eats him away. It's like all he can think about. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, you know, the most I've won was like, I don't know, I've won like a couple Nagas, I guess. not a knock on Naga. I'm just saying it's, you know, I've only done like local, like stuff within Atlanta here. So when I hear someone doing like a world championship level tournament and winning and becoming a world champion and being disgruntled by the fact that they weren't able to get exactly what they wanted to accomplish along the way, really blew my mind. And he's not the only one that I've seen do that. They, you know, there's a lot of guys who they're just so deeply obsessed with being razor precise and perfect. And it's fascinating. It's really fascinating to see just how deep it goes and how much it means to them. You know, when they're talking about their training and their competition success.
Yeah. I mean, it's, what is it? There's a book by one of the advertising execs. And I think the title was, it's not how good you are, it's how good you're going to be, or something like that. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that always stuck with me. It stuck with me that it's that constant looking for the next level, right? It's never resting on your laurels. It's constant progress.
Recently, I was listening to David Goggins' appearance on Joe Rogan, and he's someone that talks about that a lot. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great mindset to have. And when you kind of analyze people who have achieved great things, whether it's in, you know, martial arts and sports or in business, it's always that kind. You always notice those little things. You notice those little obsessions on being perfect and pushing yourself, you know, as far as you can get. And it's something that I've definitely noticed along the way. By the way, man, I don't know if you're aware of it, you got mentioned in that interview on Joe Rogan.
Yeah, man, that's when I realized, like, I think it's the second time he's mentioned that yoga quote, but every time he does, I mean, I must get told by like 30 or 40 people, like in messages. And like, I mean, he's a popular dude. He's clearly at the top of his game, which is awesome. You know, that when it came coming back to the perfectionist thing, one of the things I've had to understand is that you need to look at the place where it's coming from, because I think perfectionism, when it comes from the wrong place, is something that leads you down a negative path and leads you ultimately to burnout and self-hatred, because it is an impossible ideal. You're never going to be perfect in any aspect of your life. But if it comes from a good place, which is like a healthy, whole integrated psyche, and just knowing that there's always room for improvement and you enjoy that process of trying to improve, I mean, it is a recipe for success and happiness, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's funny that you said that too, because I'm definitely someone that if I was really, really basing all of my happiness on how well and on how perfect I was in any aspect, I would for sure be pretty disappointed on a regular basis. And so when I hear people like Hodger talk about that, it's like, man, that must be stressful, though. You know what I mean? Like to be at that level and to be, you know, considered one of the best on the planet of all time in your respective sport, and still not being satisfied with it, and still kind of eating yourself up about little mistakes that were made along the way. Mm-hmm. That's got to be tough, man. And I wouldn't be able to personally balance that.
In his case, it probably comes from a good place, not a bad place. I think a lot of perfectionism is derived, ultimately the root of it is self-hatred or a lack of self-acceptance. And that's been a big theme that I've been exploring, in particular over the last year, which is that deeply and completely accepting myself for who I am and realizing that I, like everyone else, I am perfect in spite of my imperfections. And some people would argue that we are perfect because of our imperfections. And that doesn't mean you just say, okay, I'm fine, I'm never going to improve, or I'm never going to work on myself, or I'm never going to try to do things better. It's realizing that, you know, at the root of it all, you are a flawed human being, and that's okay. That's okay. You know, it doesn't preclude you from getting better or striving to be better, but it doesn't mean that there is something wrong with you. And that's, I think jiu-jitsu can eat you up. I have noticed I've seen it do it to other people. I've seen that in myself as well, where you're constantly beating yourself up because, you know, some guy beat you, or he swept you, or you did failed that move, or you only a purple belt, no offense. and then, you know, you start like you know, you lose a competition. I'll never forget seeing this one kid, like this British kid, I can't remember his name, but he was a good competitor at the time. And he I was at this tournament, I was coaching one of my friends or a student, and this kid, he had just lost a match and he was crying. And this kid was good, dude. Very, very good. Like, he was the up and coming young dude. He was just sitting in the corner crying. And I said to him, "What's wrong with you, dude? What's happened?" And he was like, "Oh, I lost. And I know I could have beat that guy." And I just, that was unhealthy, dude. Something about it to me, I was just like, yeah, okay, look, I understand the will to win and the will to conquer and be the best and everything. But, you know, that kind of, to me, it just didn't seem right. And the problem is, when you define yourself through one thing, when that one thing is taken from you, and it will be taken from you, whether it's through age or like there's a better competitor or, you know, someone else comes along who supersedes you or you get injured, and you've based your entire self-worth on that thing and it's gone, then what are you? You know, then that's a very hollow existence. Remember in South Africa, there was this swimmer who she broke this particular record of the swim to Robben Island, the island where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned. And she broke the record, and she was obsessed when she was trying to break the record. She became this celebrated person, and people were taking her out for dinner, and the press was, you know, like all over. And then this lasted for a few months, and then someone else broke the record. And I remember she went through this like depression and this crisis because she had built her whole understanding of who she was and the fact that she was this amazing swimmer who held this particular distinction. And it always stuck with me then. I realized, like, in life you have to never let that happen to you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely it does. Yeah. And it's cool too, because I think that jiu-jitsu kind of naturally prepares us for these kinds of things. Like the biggest thing that jiu-jitsu's done for me in my life, I think, is it's forced me to face myself in the rawest form. You know, I think a lot of people go through their life kind of convincing themselves that their inadequacies are not as bad as they are, or they just completely don't even allow themselves to acknowledge that they even exist. Mm-hmm. And I think with jiu-jitsu, it forces people to really, you know, it crushes your ego first and foremost. Mm-hmm. It's really, really difficult to keep showing up and to keep getting good, while you're getting smashed along the way. Mm-hmm. And then of course, if you compete, then, you know, you can multiply that by 10, because it's just, you know, there's lots of ups and downs. Jiu-jitsu is not the kind of sport that you can win all the time. Nobody wins all the time. You lose as much as you win. It's just, and I'm talking about like the best in the world. They lose a lot too. Mm-hmm. And I think that, yeah, I think that jiu-jitsu just gives people a better perspective of who they actually are and what they're actually worth. And that kind of helps you just approach life a little bit more laid back. You feel like you don't have so much to prove to the rest of the world, because you're already, it's like you said, you learn to love yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's something you've really embraced in your life. And I think that jiu-jitsu kind of, whether people realize it or not, it's kind of naturally does that to you. Mm-hmm. You know,
mm-hmm. You know, I was reminded of when you said, like, a lot of people over or underestimate their shortcomings. It's interesting. There's a spiritual teacher called John DeMartini. And to the listeners, I highly recommend his books. I highly, highly recommend this guy. He's shaped my perception of the world largely through his teachings. But he says the average human being is always there's a dichotomy within the average human being, which is that they amplify their criticisms 50%, and they also underreport their shortcomings 50%. That's the average human being, which I thought was very, very interesting. And that I'm always searching in my life, where am I giving myself too much credit and where am I giving myself not enough credit? Because it's not only one or the other. You're always doing both. So in jiu-jitsu, even I'm watching in my game, am I giving myself too much? Am I thinking I'm too good from the mount position, or am I beating myself up too much from my crappy half guard or whatever it is? I'm always asking those two questions together, if that makes sense.
It does, absolutely, yeah. And I think that, you know, it's really healthy to have something like jiu-jitsu. And for other people, it's not jiu-jitsu. There's other things out there that exist that kind of help you balance out and sort of analyze yourself. But for me personally, it's literally taking people, you know, trying to break my arms and choking me to make me really focus on myself a little bit better. But I think that especially now, like in modern times, everyone's on social media and people have sort of an avatar of who they actually are online, and they want things to be, you know, filtered. Every picture needs to be filtered. Every post needs to make sure that everyone knows how awesome your life is and how there's not a moment of your day that's boring or dull or that you regret. And I think that in times like that, especially, man, people can become real narcissistic, almost to the point of, like, you know, megalomania sometimes, as they get so incredibly full of themselves and sort of feeding into their own character almost that they created themselves. That having something that reminds you at the end of the day, like, hey, man, I went to this place today where this, you know, 130-pound computer programmer almost ended my life. And if I didn't tap, I would have passed out. And, you know, if that was a real situation, he could have murdered me.
That's so cool. Yeah, I totally agree. That's a cool way to put it. People I'm starting to understand that in this very strange time in which we live, where things like Instagram, which are amazing tools and help keep us connected, but as you said, we are presented this very filtered perception of everyone's life. And I found that one of the people I actually look up to is her name is Rachel Braith, and she's known as Yoga Girl on Instagram, and my fiance is a huge fan of hers. And she said one of the reasons she likes her is she isn't just talking about how amazing her life is, and she isn't just putting up pictures of herself doing these amazing yoga postures. Sometimes she puts up a picture and says, I had a really shit day today, you know. And I think people appreciate that. They want to know that, you know, like, no one, doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter how much money you have or how many followers you have or how good looking you are or how many world championships you've won, you know, everyone's got shit that they're dealing with, dude. That's part of the human experience. Like, if you show me someone who doesn't have any problems, then I'll show you a dead person. So I appreciate that. You know, Ryan, I wanted to ask you one more question, and that is, Grappling Central podcast has become a great success. And I know that didn't just happen through luck. You put a lot of work into it and a lot of focus into it. And what I really admire and respect about you is that you are doing this. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who would like to do something within their passion as a career and use it to pay their bills. And you're doing that. And the reason I respect the way you're doing it is because you don't have a side job. This is your job. That's how you know, on Shark Tank, when they always, like, they ask the guy, like, what are you doing on the side? And if he says he hasn't quit his job, they don't take him seriously. They only take him seriously once he's thrown his hat over the fence and committed fully. And I wanted to ask you, like, if there were the listeners out there, there were some of them who, like, you know, maybe they're a young purple belt or a blue belt and they just are absolutely crazy about jiu-jitsu and they want to make it their career and the thing that pays their bills. What advice would you give them? And maybe could you tell us a little bit about how you did that with Grappling Central?
Yeah, absolutely. So, man, my situation when I started the show was pretty unique. The podcast happened because of a series of events that went down a few years ago. I told you about the craziness that Karen and I went through to get her back into the U.S. What I didn't mention was that almost a week after she got back into the U.S., after that whole struggle, I got laid off from my job at a warehouse here in Atlanta. And Karen at the time didn't have a work permit, so now all of a sudden we're in this desperate situation where I'm unemployed and she can't legally work. And of course, if they catch her working side jobs and stuff, they'll revoke her green card. So, you know, it was pretty crazy. And I was thankfully able to find a corporate security job. I was sitting in a truck booth for about 6 months in the evenings, checking in vehicles that were coming onto this property, this manufacturing facility. And obviously it didn't pay very much. And I almost had to go back to working bar and nightclub security like I used to, just to make more money, which I really didn't want to do. So thankfully, a friend of mine got me a spot in the small tech company that he worked for at the time, and I was able to quit the truck booth gig, and things kind of became stable again. But it was during my time sitting in that truck booth all night that I really got into podcasts. You know, I thought it was a great way for people to find interesting conversations and learn things, as well as just a great medium for entertainment. I love music and everything, but after a couple weeks, I'd pretty much exhausted all my music playlists, so I was looking for something different to listen to. listen to. And as I was scrolling around and finding shows I liked, I noticed that there were only a few jiu-jitsu podcasts at that time, and I thought it would be really cool to start my own thing. And I noticed that there weren't many jiu-jitsu podcasts that sat down one-on-one with a guest and really got to know kind of the human side of the legends of the sport and hear their story. And that's something that always fascinated me, not just about jiu-jitsu athletes, but about people in general who found success in their field. I've always wondered, you know, what it is that sets them apart, you know, where they came from and the trials and tribulations they went through to get to where they are. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, we're all just a kid from some town, right? So I thought it would be really cool to sit with these guys and kind of figure out what makes them tick, you know, what makes, how have their life experiences led them to being world champions or world-renowned instructors? How do their minds work? What motivates them? So honestly, when I first had this idea in the beginning, I really just planned on pursuing it purely out of personal interest of these things. I had no plans to ever make a career out of it or anything like that. And I sat on the idea for about a year when all of a sudden the small tech company that my friend got me into announced that they lost their biggest account and they were going under. So all of a sudden, you know, after a year of stability, I was back to square one again as a broke newly married guy without a plan. And the company gave us a severance package that would last us about 3 to 4 months of paying rent and bills. And Nick, man, at this point, I was just exhausted, man. I was so tired of busting my ass for other people and to have nothing to show for it in the end. And I realized that even if I got another decent job, stability was really just an illusion and any time it could be pulled out from under me. So I did a lot of soul searching and a lot of sulking during the first couple weeks after that. But then I had an epiphany and you know, I'll never forget it. I was in the shower and I was racking my brain on what to do with myself. And I knew I didn't want to send out more resumes and I knew I didn't want to apply for other jobs. And I decided I was just going to do my own thing, sink or swim, no matter what happens. And thankfully, Karen stuck by my side during this very bleak time and supported the idea. In fact, she's the artist behind all the characters of the guests that the show's known for on social media, so she's become a big part of it herself. But originally, my vision for grapplingcentral.com was to make a Sports Illustrated type website just for grappling. In fact, looking back, it's kind of funny. It would have probably looked a lot like Flow Grappling does now, or other similar sites like that. And I wanted to have like news articles and videos and blogs and then a podcast as a little side bonus thing on the website. And since I'd been sitting on the podcast idea for a year, I was most excited about that. And so that's where I started. I just started, you know, putting together some guests and some questions and some ideas. And I quickly realized the amount of work and time it would take to run a podcast with a format like mine. And you know how it is because you have guests as well. So it's much different than just turning on a microphone and talking by yourself or with a friend in the room. You know, when you have guests, there's so much extra work that goes into it between scheduling and writing and editing and, you know, everything else. So it quickly dawned on me that there was no way I was going to be able to run a podcast and the website like the one I was imagining simultaneously. There just wouldn't be enough hours in the day and I'm only one person. So I eventually decided to just stick with the podcast by itself since that's what really was exciting me the most. And I think that ended up being the right choice. You know, we're almost at 300 episodes now, and the growth has been mind-blowing. As far as the advice for people listening, I think the best advice I can offer is a lesson that I learned along the way with the podcast. I used to see people who worked for themselves and entrepreneurs as these guys who just had it made. Like they could go any day they wanted to and just play golf during the day or, you know, screw around and have fun. They didn't have a clock to punch into or a boss to report to. And it appeared that they just lived this fantasy life. But once I started doing it myself, man, I realized that that couldn't be further from the truth. You know, on an average week running the podcast, I'd say I put in about 80 hours worth of work, typically about 12 hours a day. And even when I'm not actually physically sitting at my desk and working on things, my mind never really turns off when it comes to thinking about the show. I drive Karen nuts all the time. We'll be sitting at dinner somewhere or at a park or something on a day off, and I'll pull out my phone and start taking notes and ideas and adding things to my to-do list and responding and interacting with listeners on social media. And she has to get on me a lot to kind of, you know, give myself some free time away from the show. So I think the lesson to take away from that is that, yes, you can absolutely pursue your passion. passion and work for yourself and chase your dreams if you're willing to work tirelessly at it. To be successful at anything on your own, you have to put in more hours than you've ever worked in a regular job. And for a long time, you'll have to do it for free. And that's the thing that was really tough. I didn't make a penny off the podcast until almost a year after it started. And that's with, that 80-hour, 12-hour-a-day kind of schedule. So obviously, it's very, very tiring, and it's a marathon. Statistically, only like 1% of podcasts actually make any money. So there were a lot of times in the first year running the show that I'd say to myself after a full day of work, like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, why? How's this ever going to take off? Did I just waste a year of my life on something that's not going to come to fruition? And I firmly believe that if you have a passion and you grind hard enough for long enough, something will happen. Even if it isn't the thing that you were grinding away on initially. Some people work tirelessly on a project that leads to a completely different thing that then becomes the main thing they find their success with. And I know this is a long-winded answer, and I appreciate anyone who's still listening. But my advice is to find what you're passionate about, find a way that you can have a niche within that passion, and then do everything you can to be as unique as possible. Don't just be a copy of someone that's already there. Bring your own flavor, bring your own style to the table, and just be ready to grind hard and make it happen. Whether it's as jiu-jitsu guys, a very common avenue is to open up your own academy someday. Some people start YouTube channels. Some people start podcasts. There's all different kinds of ways to go about it. But whatever it is, just find it. Find a way that you can do it very uniquely as your own thing, and just work for it, man. Just grind away.
Wow, that's great advice, Ryan. And I just want to tell you congratulations. It warms my heart to hear that, man. I know it's not a huge industry, and it's not always easy to get by. And the fact that you did that under those circumstances is very cool. And you deserve all the success in the world, my friend.
No, that means a lot, Professor. I really appreciate that.
Cool.
By the way, just to throw it out there, if you guys haven't heard Professor Nick's episode on my show, it was one of our most popular episodes. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but that was one of our most downloaded episodes. People really,
I'm happy to hear it.
Yeah, they loved our conversation.
I'm sure this will be one of my most downloaded episodes, dude, because this is a good one. If the listeners want to find out more about Grappling Central or anything else that you do, where should they go, bud?
Yeah, so we're on iTunes. We're pretty much on all platforms where you can find podcasts. So we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher Radio, Spotify, Google Play, our iHeartRadio, and then there's several Android apps like Podcast Addict, Podbean, Podcast Republic. So if you go in there and you type in Jiu-Jitsu or BJJ, we'll surely pop up. And then we also have a YouTube channel where we post some of the audio of the episodes, and we have a few videos here and there. I'm trying to get a little bit more active with making videos. Mm-hmm. I think that's about it. And then, of course, grapplingcentral.com is our website.
That's great, man. Okay, my brother, thank you again for your time, and I'm sure we'll have you on the show again as a guest.
Absolutely. No, I really appreciate it, Nick. Thank you so much for having me. By the way, I hope you're having fun out in Arizona. My brother still really wants to train with you. He moved out to Phoenix. He's training at Helson Gracie Phoenix.
Okay.
And I know he wants to make the trip to Tucson to see you still. So.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm going to meet him one day soon.
Excellent.
Okay, you take care, Ryan. You can literally hear in Ryan's voice that he's just a friendly and cool dude, and he's the kind of person I'd want to hang out with off the mats. Never met him in person, but just after speaking to him a couple of times, I know that he would just be just a really cool dude to be around. Some people have a fake humility and a fake friendliness, but I don't get that from Ryan. He's the genuine article, and you have to admire what he accomplished. I mean, I know that this industry, it's not a huge industry, and it's not necessarily an easy thing to be a professional in it and to use it to support you. And for him to have done that is awesome. I also know just how difficult like long distance relationships can be. And hearing the stories of the issues that he had with his wife when they were trying to get visas and all that kind of stuff. I hear him, and I know that that's not easy. And so for him to share that with us, that's awesome. Please check out his show, Grappling Central Podcast. It's one of the better ones out there. I'd say it's one of the best ones out there, actually. And also, if you haven't had a chance yet, go check out my new online membership site, the Master Academy. It is really world class. Okay, guys, hope you enjoyed that. Peace out.